It's 10:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Earlier this year, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA, a member schools, voted to allow for the first time since 1973 four-year guaranteed athletic scholarships. Now, when I first read this, I thought I had misread it. I mean, weren't scholarships always 4 years? Isn't that the point of the scholar-athlete? He or she goes to school and earns a four-year degree, in return for which that scholar-athlete performs for the school's athletic program. Quid pro quo, right? Well, apparently not. Even with the rule change, very few schools are willing to dole out a four-year guaranteed scholarship to an incoming athlete. And by the way, Big Ten schools do give four-year scholarships. So why the opposition? Well, a player might get hurt, they might not play as well as advertised, the coach might simply not like the individual, or there might be a new coach with a new philosophy who doesn't want any of the old regime hanging around. Any of these reasons could get a scholarship yanked. Fair or not, this is how the system works. We're going to talk about that this hour, and we invite you to join the discussion. Here's how to get in touch. Phone number 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show page on Facebook and leave a comment or a question there. My guest is Josh Levine, executive editor of Slate Magazine and host of Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen. Today we're talking about his most recent piece, The Most Evil Thing About College Sports. Josh Levine, good morning. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
What put you on to this story? What prompted your column?
I have known about this for a while. I grew up in Louisiana, and I'm a follower of LSU football and SEC football in general, and this is a phenomenon that's pretty pervasive in the Southeastern Conference, where you'll get players who are cut from the football team every year. Now, coaches might say that it's because they've violated a team rule, or they've just decided to transfer to another program, but there's just not that much transparency. So it's not entirely clear why players leave these programs. But in the last few years, there have been a few cases at LSU, a quarterback named Chris Garrett, and a few players at Alabama who've actually come out and said that they didn't leave the programs by choice, that the coaches just revoked their scholarships, and that there's been kind of a break in this omerta, and that's what got me interested in the phenomenon.
Well, I mean, there shouldn't be any question in anyone's mind that big-time college football is a business. They have a product to sell, and they make, billions of dollars in revenue in aggregate, if you put all the programs together,
right,
from merchandising and television and so forth. And the players, the product itself, they get very little of this, and that's been a debate, a discussion that's been going on. There was a huge article in The Atlantic that you reference in your column about this, and there's been a lot of talk. So, I mean, it's no question that this is a business. So I guess what I want to know is at the Division I level of college sports,
mm-hmm.
The idea of the student athlete as a pure amateur is really, that's at best, it's wink, wink, nudge, nudge, but really it's a myth.
I would definitely agree with that. And I think that the reason that I wrote this story is that this one-year scholarship situation really reveals the fundamental hypocrisy here of these institutions, to my mind. Because people who support the idea that college athletes should not be paid, what they say is they are getting paid. They're getting this valuable education that is worth up to $200,000 for 4 years. But the truth is that they're not really guaranteed that education, and they're not getting that compensation. The coach can decide at his whim that the player is not going to receive that 4 years of schooling that I think most fans believe and assume that they are guaranteed.
Well, and the truth is, I mean, even if you are a good student, if you're a Division I college athlete, it's pretty difficult to actually get your degree in 4 years. And so once you've used up your eligibility, well, no more scholarship. So you're not guaranteed a college degree. You're guaranteed a certain amount of support for 4 years, and when your eligibility is up, well, you know, go finish on your own.
Right, and I think what a lot of college athletes will tell you is that the school loses interest in their schooling and their education after they're no longer useful on the athletic field, and that there's a lot of academic support while, you know, they are starring on the football team or the basketball team that's designed to help them stay eligible. But once they're no longer competing and the school doesn't have that interest, you're really on your own, and perhaps you haven't built up the sorts of academic skills that you need to carry you through.
We're primarily talking about Division I football and basketball as the primary.
Right.
They're the primary money drivers of this thing.
Right.
There are other sports that where there are scholarships at the Division I level, but they are perhaps less well. In my part of the country, hockey is Division I hockey is really huge. These are the sports that are driving this. Do we have a sense of how scholarship athletes are treated in other sports, soccer, lacrosse, volleyball, any of that?
Well, one really interesting phenomenon is the idea of transferring. And I think that's another really fundamental unfairness of big-time college sports. And the three that you just mentioned, men's ice hockey, basketball and football, are the ones in which Division I athletes have to sit out if they transfer for a year. And this was an issue at Wisconsin, if you're aware of the controversy of Bo Ryan refusing to release one of his basketball players. And if the coach refuses to release you to a given school for any reason, then you have to sit out for 2 years. But in other sports, this is not the case. If you want to transfer as a lacrosse player to another school for whatever reason, if you want a different athletic opportunity or academic opportunity, then you can just go and play right away. I think the way players are treated in those other sports is far more humane, and I think that's a great example of that.
Would a student get a scholarship while they sat out their year if there was essentially a hold placed on them?
I believe that they would, although I'm not 100% sure on that.
Mm-hmm. The problem in part is that in looking at this purely from a coach's standpoint, there are a finite number of scholarships. I mean, what is it in football? Is it 85?
It's 85. That seems sufficient to me, but I'm not a football coach.
Well, and other sports, it's less,
right.
And they just reduced the number of scholarships in Division I men's ice hockey a few years ago, but there's a finite number of slots, and you can have, the coach is being paid to put a winning team on the field by whatever means he can, and say let's use football as an example. You want your program to succeed, and you want to your coach is supposed to put a winning team on by whatever means are necessary within the rules. And as we've seen a few times a year in every year for as long as I can remember, even beyond the rules. But the idea is you're there to win. And so from the coach's perspective, so Johnny Recruit gets injured in his first game of his freshman year, and it's going to be a year and a half to recuperate. I got to fill that slot with somebody. So sorry, Johnny, but you're gone. And I don't mean to be cynical about this, but from the coach's perspective, how else are they going to keep their job?
Right, and I think that's exactly why you need these sorts of rules, because you've got to protect the athletes against what might be in the coach's interest. And, the coach's interest is not necessarily what we should all be rooting for and validating. So I think you've highlighted a great example of why there needs to be a four-year scholarship. Another example is when a new coach will come in, for example, you know, Rich Rodriguez to Michigan, and he has a spread offense, a different kind of offensive system, and he might want to get rid of athletes that were recruited by the prior coach and bring in, you know, his new recruits who better fit his system. Well, that seems like a really crummy reason to, you know, run off athletes. It seems like more of a pro system. And if we're going to if we're going to buy this idea that there's at least some educational mission here, that these aren't just minor league pro franchises, and that seems like something, again, that we would want to guard against, is players being run off for no other reason than the coach doesn't want them there.
It seems to me that looking at this, that there's a tremendous risk for the student athlete, and I'll continue to use that term. They give up in return for this scholarship, which could be taken away at any time. They give up all rights to the commercial use of their likeness.
Yeah,
they can't make any money from their own. From their own success. They're not allowed. It's absolutely against the rules. So if I'm a star basketball player and I go out and I'm averaging 40 points a game and everybody wants my autograph, I can't sell my own picture. I do not have any control over my image, but the school and the NCAA can go out and make literally millions of dollars selling me. And in return, what do I get? Well, as long as I'm popular, I get to stay in school. And if I get hurt or whatever, you know, well, tough beans, you know, see ya. The commentary that I've read about this is mostly, you know, how is this fair that we even allow this?
Yeah, and there are a couple of court cases now brought by former athletes that are looking at these questions of likeness rights with regards to things like jersey sales and the players' images being used in video games. And the players' likenesses, you know, the schools can exploit them in perpetuity. It's not just in the period, you know, during which they're in school. And, you know, you correctly pointed out that Terrell Pryor sold, you know, a pair of his pants for a few thousand dollars and, you know, lost eligibility for five games. You know, that's a great example of something that players aren't allowed to do. And meanwhile, you know, the school can sell, you know, a jersey with his number on it and make, you know, tens or hundreds or millions of dollars, and, you know, he sees none of that money.
Can you tell us about the Ed O'Bannon case?
Yeah, I believe that is the one about, you know, likenesses and whether athletes own, you know, the rights to their own images. And it seems absurd that they don't. You know, that's basically what we were just talking about with, you know, athletes not being able to profit off of, you know, their own image, their own jersey number, and cases like that.
I don't want to get too far down the legal mumbo jumbo language or the details, but I'm assuming that at some point an athlete receiving a scholarship has to sign a paper acknowledging the receipt of the scholarship, and I'm assuming that the conditions in the paper, the fine print in there, is what is where they sign away their rights to their own image. Because absent that, it would be a pretty clear-cut case of misappropriation of identity if they hadn't signed something giving the NCAA and the institution giving them the scholarship the right to use use their image.
Yeah, I mean, they sign away a lot of this stuff in the national letter of intent that they sign in order to get these scholarships, and it's not really in the school's interest or the NCAA's interest to really educate athletes into what they're signing. And I think a lot of them feel like they have no choice, and I think they also feel like you know, in this case, getting back to the original issue of the four-year scholarship and versus the one-year scholarship, I think a lot of them feel like this isn't going to happen to them, that they're, you know, never going to be cut, that they're going to be a star for 4 years, and so this isn't relevant to them. And so you haven't really seen a broad-based movement by these, you know, high schoolers who often just don't really know what it is they're signing.
All right. 800-486-8655. That's the number to call if you'd like to get involved in this discussion. Are you a college athlete or the parent of a current college athlete or maybe a prospective college athlete? Do you have a son or daughter who has been courted by Division I schools seeking to use their talents? And what has been your experience with this? Are you aware of some of this stuff? I'd like to hear from you. Are you a former college athlete who may have had experience with a scholarship incident like the ones we're talking about here? Love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave a comment there. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Almost 24 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up after 2 o'clock today on Talk of the Nation. When it comes to the standard test that screens for prostate cancer, a government task force essentially told men they're better off not knowing. Talk about that after 2, plus the president's auto czar on Romney, the bailout, and Bain. That's on Talk of the Nation after 2 o'clock this afternoon. This hour we're talking about the situation with the scholarships for athletes at Division I schools. And what prompted this was an article for Slate, "The Most Evil Thing About College Sports." We have the author of that article, who's also the executive editor of Slate Magazine and host of Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, Josh Levine. We're getting callers lined up, and we'll take a call in just a moment. If you call in and the lines are busy, please feel free to send an email to talk@wpr.org or leave a comment on Facebook as well. Actually, let's go to the phones now. We'll start in Adams, and we'll hear first from Steve. Steve, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I'm a former college swimmer, and I'm now an attorney. One of the points that you were making about how high school athletes could get some better representation in talking to their school or to the NCAA is kind of a difficult thing to do, because if they get an attorney, they're running the risk of violating the rule against having an agent. And I just wanted to see what your guest has to say about that, what sort of comment he has.
I think that's a great point, and it gets into some of the, you know, issues that high school athletes have in maintaining their eligibility. You know, they can't go, you know, take money from anyone to go visit colleges, which is something that, you know, a lot of us take for granted if we've come from, you know, upper middle class backgrounds, that you might want to go around and look at schools. But if, you know, you want to go on an unofficial visit as a high school athlete and you take money from a friend, then that'll be considered a booster and you'll lose your eligibility. So I think the caller makes a great point there. There are some resources, though, for high school athletes, you know, to look at, you know, online and elsewhere. But, you know, I think that that's a good point.
Well, what's the role of high school coaches in all of this? I mean, wouldn't it make sense to educate them? Because I would think that they're kind of the gateway for schools who are recruiting. They're kind of the gateway to get access to the players in the first place, aren't they?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And you would hope that high school coaches were more aware of some of these issues. But I think they often see you know, the acquisition of a college scholarship as the end game here. And I think it is a worthy goal, you know, to get these guys into school and get them, you know, an opportunity to advance in that way. But, you know, I just think that for fans and even for coaches as well as players, there's just not generally an awareness that this isn't a four-year ticket.
The NCAA is a very powerful organization, to say the least. I mean, in most things, it's their way or the highway. But how much influence does it really have in Division I football? Is it the same as in other sports, or are the conferences where the power in the NCAA really lies these days?
Yeah, I think that's an astute comment. I mean, everyone has to follow the NCAA rules. So I think it is, you know, the governing body that still has power, and they still, you know, have the ability to penalize schools for flouting their rules. But, you know, the conferences like, you know, the SEC and the Big Ten strike their own television deals, and they do have some ability to control their own practices. So, you know, and police themselves a bit. Like you said, the majority of the Big Ten schools have decided to offer these four-year deals. Not every school. Purdue, Indiana, and Minnesota are still awarding one-year renewable grants. So if the University of Wisconsin fans want to hold it over their rivals, that's a good reason to do so.
The history of this is that there was a rule change in 1973 to ban four-year scholarships. Was it policy prior to that to allow them or to mandate them? I guess, I haven't paid a lot of attention to this until I read your article, but my assumption was that all these scholarships had always been four-year scholarships, and I was surprised to find out that they weren't. What was the situation prior to 1973?
Well, the history of this is really fascinating. Back in the 1940s is when athletic scholarships really started to be put into place, and it never actually really had an academic purpose. The reason that schools started giving these scholarships, and if I focus on football here, was to compete with the then powers in the Big Ten and the Ivy League, and it was used as a recruitment tool to say, you know, we're not as renowned as some of these schools in the Ivy League and the Big Ten, but if you come here, we'll give you a scholarship. And so it started to proliferate around the NCAA, and it wasn't, you know, it started in the South, but then it spread around the country, and it started to, you know, be a four-year deal. And then in the early 70s, the NCAA actually banned it and made it so that you could only give a one-year scholarship. And the reason that was given was that schools were afraid that athletes would show up to school, have this four-year deal, and then refuse to play. And so this one-year deal was put in place to kind of wrest the power from the athlete and put it in the hands of the school. And now, I think that's ridiculous. I think you can put a stipulation in place that if the athlete refuses to play, then you can take away their scholarship. I don't think that's a reason to mandate that every scholarship be 1 year.
I'm trying to imagine a situation where a student had a chance to play their favorite sport at a Division I school and got a scholarship and said, "Okay, I got your money. See ya. I'm just going to go to school and get my education. I'm not going to play anymore. I'm going, you know, okay. In what bizarro world is that going to be true?"
And, you know, one other point that we should make is that, you know, the majority of schools, I think, that are in, you know, that are playing Division I football, not all of them are these big football powerhouses, and that a lot of the opposition that's been made is one of expense, and that a school, Boise State, made this objection publicly. They said that, "We can't afford this. We can't afford four-year scholarships." You know, like in the example that you said earlier, if a guy, you know, happens not to work out and we're required to pay for his education for 4 years, that's going to bankrupt us. That's their reasoning.
Well, let's say then that that's the case, that you, okay, that's that from the school's point of view. And again, looking, if we just, everybody just admits, which I think seems to be one of the big problems, everybody just admits that that this is really a professional sport. And then, okay, then let's create a business relationship between the player and the school. And if we're going to give out one-year scholarships and we have an out clause if you get hurt, then the players should be receiving, according to some people who I've read and some I've heard on and watched on television, the sports pundits. If that's going to be the case, then the players deserve to get a cut of the money that the NCAA and the schools are collecting from television and merchandising and ticket sales and so forth, just to even out the playing field a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that seems fair to me. And the fundamental unfairness here is, you know, that Boise State, they're giving that reasoning about how it's going to bankrupt them and they can't afford it. And that's why they want one-year scholarships and the ability to, you know, cut an underperforming player. But again, the player can't leave if they choose to leave. It's a one-way street. If they decide they want to transfer, they have to sit out.
We'd maybe need to get a lawyer on to answer this one, but boy, it seems to me like there's a really good potential antitrust suit here somewhere. Let's go back to the phones and hear from Jim in Madison next. Jim, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. Go ahead.
I was listening to your conversation, and I'm entirely sympathetic to your point of view regarding the presumptive exploitation of these student athletes in this negotiation process. But it is still a negotiated process where contracts are being signed, and students do have the option to opt out of the terms that are presented to them by the universities. I'm just kind of wondering what your thoughts were regarding the other side of this equation. And while the schools have a leveraged position in the negotiations and advantage, you know, again, students really can choose not to agree to this, to coming to that school and paying for a particular athletic department.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And there have been a few isolated cases. One I cited in my article was DeMarcus Cousins, who you might know as an NBA player now for the Sacramento Kings. When he was making his college choice, he wanted to go to Alabama Birmingham to play for a coach named Mike Davis. And he told the school, you know, all right, I'll go here, but if Mike Davis leaves, I want it in writing that I'll be able to leave the school without penalty and go wherever else I want. They refused to do that, and so Cousins just went to Kentucky. He's like, all right, I don't have to agree to your terms. And I think there need to be other star players like him who, you know, are willing to use their power and, you know, get deals specifically written for them. I'm not sure why that case isn't cited more and other people don't follow his example, but I think the vast, vast majority of athletes are not in that kind of power dynamic and, you know, are just willing to sign whatever they get in front of them for the opportunity, you know, the life-changing opportunity to get a scholarship and to be able to play big-time college sports.
Well, we're talking about 15, 16, 17-year-old youths. These are kids who are being courted by these programs, and wow, I mean, that has to be really exciting.
For sure.
And you know, oh man, you know, and you meet some famous coach, and he shakes your hand, and he tells you, you know, what a great future you're going to have at good old State U, and you might end up playing in the NFL or in the NBA, and they dangle all this stuff in front of you, and listen, kid, all you got to do is sign here, and all your troubles are over. Even if the parents are involved, how much do they even know? And again, I think the point that Joshua makes our caller made is a good one. It is a negotiation, but how informed are these young men and women who are signing these papers, how much do they really know? How do they understand? And what's the difference between a Cousins playing basketball? He was going to be a superstar wherever he went, and some offensive right tackle from Iblink, Minnesota. And in terms of the relative power that these people have.
Right. And so that's why I think that it's, the guys like Cousins who are going to be the ones who set the example and show that this is possible, because it's not going to be the majority. It's not going to be the guy from Iblink, Minnesota. They're just going to sign whatever gets thrust in front of them. And, they're not going to have the knowledge or the representation, I think, unfortunately, if we're thinking about it realistically.
And I'm wondering if anyone has ever said, has ever negotiated and said, listen, okay, I'll come and play for you, but I want the rights to my image. You can't put me in a video game without paying me. And if they did try to negotiate that, is that even allowed by NCAA rules?
That I'm not sure about. That would be fascinating. And I should make clear, you were talking about the O'Bannon case before, and what is being specifically argued in that case is the ability to use the likenesses of players after their college careers are over. What O'Bannon saw was that his likeness was being used from when he was in UCLA in a video game, showing classic teams. And this was, decades after he had finished his playing career.
And the NCAA position on this is, we own your image for life?
That is correct.
Let's take a call from La Crosse next, and David is on the line with us. David, good morning.
Good morning. I guess I have a little different perspective than you and your guest. I was awarded a scholarship in the early 60s to the University of Minnesota. And I will forever be grateful, because without that scholarship, I would have worked in the local factory for 40 years. But because of the scholarship, I was able to complete school and be a teacher and a coach. What a wonderful opportunity.
I think
athletes are paid in more than money.
David, let me ask you.
A wonderful life. Well,
David, hang on a second. I just want to ask you, were you guaranteed 4 years at Minnesota, or was it a one-year-at-a-time deal?
It was a four-year deal. However, and to be a little clear, I left after 3 years, and that wasn't the university's fault. That was my fault. I began not to attend class and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, I did go back and finish. But without that opportunity to begin with, I believe I would have been in a factory, a local factory.
David, thank you so much for the call. Josh, there are, a lot of stories like David's out there of people who actually do go through and they do get a good education. And for them, maybe that's a great deal. And maybe we're painting this with too broad a brush.
Yeah, I think that he does have a good story. And sort of what I'm looking for is for more people to have those sorts of success stories. And maybe we're kind of harping on the folks who get a raw deal, but that's just because I think we want a greater proportion of folks to be able to have those sorts of happy outcomes. And we should also note that since David went to school in the 60s, that was before the 1973 ban on the four-year scholarship, so he got in kind of under the wire there with his four-year deal.
Well, we need to take a break, and we're going to do that now. And then when we come back, we have some more callers, we'll try and maybe get some other perspectives on this issue from you. A couple of lines just opened up if you'd like to join at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Talk at WPR.org is the email address. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave a comment or question there. I'm John Munson. In for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:42. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Tomorrow in this hour of the Kathleen Dunn program, we'll be talking about Greg Allman's book, My Cross to Bear. It's an autobiography. It tells the story of the Allman Brothers Band. And yes, there will be music. This hour we're talking about the situation regarding NCAA scholarships, 4-year versus 1-year, what happens to athletes when they get injured or the coach doesn't like them anymore, and how that whole negotiation works. My guest is Josh Levine, executive editor of Slate Magazine and host of Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen. And today we're talking about his most recent piece, The Most Evil Thing About College Sports. Josh, I think one of the things, and we alluded to this earlier, there are tens of thousands of athletes in Division I programs across the country.
Right.
If you take in, you know, everything, volleyball, wrestling, lacrosse, baseball, golf, and we don't hear very much. We don't hear very much about, for example, baseball players. We may see them come up into the major leagues after they finish their college careers, but we don't, you know, I mean, the names of the top five pitchers in Division I baseball just don't leap off the tongue unless
Sure.
unless you work for ESPN. So, you know, we don't think that much about that. And really, I think we need to probably put a little bit of a frame around this. We're really talking about men's and women's sports in basketball and then football as being the drivers of the bus here. Those are the real big income and revenue sports for most schools that have a Division I program. And frankly, I think that's why they have them, is because the school can make money with it.
It's reflected in the raw numbers as well. I mean, while you're correct that there are, you know, tens of thousands of scholarship athletes, there are 85 scholarships per Division I school in football, and, you know, in baseball, for example, it's in the low teens. So I think the priorities are reflected in the amount of scholarships that are handed out by each school.
And I missed cross country and track and field as well. I should have written it down. And we have to, you know, look where the money is. And that's where you really get I don't think EA Sports has come out with a college World Series baseball game for the latest game box. Who'd buy it?
You'd get that awesome aluminum bat ping sound, though. That would be great.
I hate that. We have an email from Tony who writes, if an athlete is injured playing a sport, who pays their medical expenses? And is there any compensation for long-term or permanent disability resulting from playing college sports? That's a great question, Tony. Thanks.
Yeah, there's, and that's why this student-athlete phrase kind of came into existence. In that article by Taylor Branch, The Shame of College Sports in the Atlantic that we were alluding to before, he kind of gets into this history and the reason that the NCAA framed its athletes as student athletes is that it didn't want to pay out workmen's compensation claims and this idea that they're employees. And that's also, you know, an issue of why maybe paying the players is going to be a thorny thing legally, is that you know, give a guy a salary, then you can't maintain this fiction that they're a student athlete, and that, you know, then you might have to pay for their disability. But yeah, to answer the question directly, you know, there's no, I think, long-term medical that comes with getting a college scholarship. You know, if you have a surgery while you're in school, I believe that the school would pay for it, but not, you know, if you have any sort of debilitating issue down the line.
Back to the phones, and we'll go to Baraboo this time and hear from Jeannie. Jeannie, good morning.
Hi, thank you for letting me on this. There are so many things I get worked up with college athletics, and even before I get into that, I do know of a woman who played basketball for UW-Madison and a young man who played football for Harvard, and Harvard doesn't give out scholarships. But, you know, you're in the school, and you get the other financial help just because you're a student there. But they both quit after a couple of years just because it was too much of a time commitment. And they said that sport, whether it be basketball or football, becomes all encompassing. You don't have the full college experience. And so there are good kids, smart kids, who just say, I don't want to do this full-time anymore. And so they give up the scholarships. But in regard to, like, paying players or taking away scholarships, if you have an academic scholarship, it's based upon the premise that you're going to maintain a certain GPA. And if it's taken away, you have to go to college just like everybody else, where you fill out the FAFSA, you work summer jobs, you know, and sometimes people say, oh, I need a bigger scholarship, or I need to get paid because I don't have enough money. Well, other kids who go to school don't have enough money either, and they have to work or take out the loans. And sometimes college athletes think they should be exempt from having to take out those loans or other things. They're not realizing how the rest of the world goes to school. And I guess those are my comments. Thank you.
Jeannie, thanks for the call. I would imagine that the difference there, though, would be that for that academic scholarship, the school isn't making a ton of money off of putting that person's image on a box of cereal or something.
Right, and I think while she makes a good point about maintaining a minimum GPA if you have an academic scholarship, there are two key points that I would make there. First, the student is extremely aware of what those requirements are when they're signing up, that they have to maintain the 3.0. If you're signing up for an athletic scholarship, it's not, you know, written in there that you need to have 10 catches a year to, you know, stay in the coach's good graces and have your scholarship renewed. It's, you know, entirely at the coach's whim, and you can get cut without cause. And second, I think that I would argue that it's not really appropriate to base, you know, your standing in school, if you're getting the scholarship, on your performance on an athletic field. That if you don't, you know, live up to whoever's expectations, you know, if you're a backup instead of a starter, then you lose your opportunity to, you know, get the free education that you signed up for. That seems wrong to me.
Bob in Door County, you'll be next. Hi, Bob. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for calling. I generally agree with the position you're espousing here. I do have a question. How does this compare to students who are in other areas? For example, the chemistry, physics majors who are participating in the research, which brings in millions and millions of dollars from large corporations, from the government, the Army, for example. These young people are doing the grunt work. They get no monetary benefit from that whatsoever. How is that different than the athlete?
Well, I would say the one difference is that research is more, I think, clearly part of the university's mission as an institution. And while I think you're correct in pointing out that there's a profit motive there, I think that's more of a generally kind of accepted role of a student who is involved at, you know, a major research institution. I think that while, you know, I'm a huge fan of college sports, and I think we can agree that they're entertaining, the kind of academic mission therein and the fact that they're attached to these, you know, supposed institutions of higher learning is more of an uneasy fit, and one that you're not going to find elsewhere kind of around the world. And so all of, you know, the stuff surrounding college sports just doesn't make as much logical sense, that a guy, you know, plays football, and that the school makes a huge amount of television revenue from that. It doesn't really have that much to do with, you know, the University of Wisconsin's academic mission in the world.
Well, let me throw another little monkey wrench into this whole thing. Bob's comment got me thinking. In the state of Wisconsin, It's illegal to use state facilities to make money for yourself. Employees can't do it. Anything that, for example, if I decide to write something and I do it on work time, the copyright to that is owned by the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin system. Mm-hmm. Same thing if a student produces a piece of video or a film while they're going to school here and they use the state's equipment to produce it. The copyright, the trademark, all of that stuff is owned by the UW system. And the rationale for that is that, look, the state built this facility, and you're getting an education here for which you're paying tuition, but we built the facility, and we own all the equipment, and you used it. Therefore, everything you produce on it belongs to us. You might run, you know, and I'm wondering if that same argument might be made in kind of a weird way for athletes as well. You know, you're using our facilities, and these are tax supported. And so, you know, we own everything. We own everything you do, just like we own everything everyone else does.
Interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way.
Let's go to Rose in Chatfield, Minnesota. Rose, good morning.
Good morning. Well, I have a very talented grandson that from Meridian, Idaho, which is right by Boise. He was the most valuable athlete of his high school and of his senior class, and he jumps hurdles, and Big Ten schools wanted him, but they didn't. The parents and he did not want that environment, and he had injured his back, too, that last year, and so they visited schools, and they ended up in Helena, Montana at Carroll College. It's a private school, Catholic mm-hmm. school. They liked the environment there, and so he ran last year, and then he was injured, and they also told the family that when he entered that school, that if he was injured, they would continue paying that scholarship. I think it's $35,000 a year. So he was injured last year, and he also got mono, so he was not running the last few months. So they redshirted him. So it's like, of course, me as the grandmother thinks. I mean, anytime you get an injury, you're worried about that. But, you know, he's over 6 feet tall, but you know, the parents, they think that that's a good environment, and I just don't know, but I just thought I would call in and tell you that. And here, Boise State, which is where his father went, and that's where he ran his famous run last year. And
well, it's good
I'm
to
sure
take care.
Feels good as the kid, but you just don't, you know, your back is such an important part of your body.
Well, it's nice that they guaranteed, you know, his scholarship, even if he did get injured, and hopefully, you know, that will come to pass. That's a great, you know, thing to get assurance of, and hopefully all athletes, you know, college athletes will get a similar assurance. That would be a great thing.
And, Rose, thanks so much for the program, or for the phone call, rather. We're getting close to the end of the program. I want to kind of tie things up here. In fact, I think let's do that. What's equitable? What would you see as an acceptable set of compromises for the situation we're in now?
Well, there is now an NCAA bylaw that says that schools have the option to give out 4-year scholarships, and as you said at the top of the show, the majority of Big Ten schools have done that. I would like to see all schools, you know, in football and basketball in particular, where this is the biggest problem, offer those 4-year scholarships. And, you know, if a school says that they're, you know, crying poor and that they can't do it, maybe they should think about what their priorities should be. And if it really would be too much of an expense for them, maybe they should drop down to a lower level of athletics. You know, not every school has to be, you know, Wisconsin or an Ohio State or an LSU or an Alabama and have these ginormous athletic programs. So, you know, if it's too much of an expense for you, then, you know, you should not, you know, do that, you know, not run these teams at the expense of the athletes that you're ostensibly, you know, supposed to be helping out.
Well, and we didn't really touch on this, but there are scholarships at the Division I A level and at the Division II level And I'm wondering what the situation is there. We really don't have time to go into it. You didn't go into that in your article because that's not really what people think about. But, I mean, there are other levels at which schools can offer
Division
scholarships.
Division II schools don't generally give athletic scholarships. So this is more of a Division I-A issue.
Okay, well, and we're talking strictly about scholarships this hour, and perhaps we can do another hour on the entire issue of workman's compensation and maybe working out some of the legal issues there so that students who maybe get a catastrophic injury get some compensation out of it. Are these employees or are they students and you know, so forth. But we won't have that discussion today because we're out of time. Josh, thanks so much for this hour. And I appreciate you being with us.
Thank you, John.
Josh Levine was my guest this morning. He's executive editor of Slate Magazine, host of Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, and his most recent piece, The Most Evil Thing About College Sports. If you missed a part of it and want to listen to it again, you can find the Kathleen Dunn show page on WPR.org, and there should be a way to click and listen as soon as the recording is finished and up. This program was produced